Welcome to Asia Calling, your window on Asia. On the show this week, we continue to follow the Rohingya humanitarian crisis. This week from India, where the Hindu nationalist government is promising to send Rohingya back to Myanmar, where they're likely to face extreme violence and persecution.
So they're thoroughly screened. They have certified all of them to be genuine refugees. They will not give a card to a person who's a terrorist.
We also take a look at Thai politics and the impact of one very influential family of billionaires. And the ancient art of herbal medicine in Afghanistan. Thanks for tuning into the show. I'm Nicole Kirby. In the midst of the deepening Rohingya humanitarian crisis in Myanmar, India's government has decided to go ahead with its plan to deport thousands of Rohingya refugees. The government argues that keeping the Rohingyas is a security threat that India cannot afford to take. But the plan is facing stiff resistance within the country and outside. And as Bismila Gilani reports, the battle is now being fought in India's Supreme Court.
Forty-year-old Mohammed Shabir lives in a refugee camp in New Delhi with his wife and three children. The family came to India in 2012, fleeing persecution in their home country, Myanmar. Shabir earns a meager living as a street vendor. But for the last few days, he hasn't been able to work. The fear of being deported is constantly on his mind.
We came here to save our lives, and after all these years, we thought we are really secure, but suddenly there is this talk of deportation. The entire Rohingya community is worried about what will happen to them. Everybody knows about the current situation in Myanmar, and in the midst of all this, the decision to send us back would be cruel and atrocious.
32-year-old Tasneem lost her home and several relatives in attacks on Rohingya people in Myanmar's western Rakhine state. She says she would rather die here than go back.
They killed everyone. They threw petrol on our house and set fire to it. My mother, father, my brother and his children all were burned to death. Where will I go now? They may as well kill us here. That is better.
The Indian government plans to deport Rohingya back to Myanmar, while violence against them has escalated in recent weeks. About 40,000 Rohingya took refuge in India in 2012 after violent attacks targeted the Muslim minority group in their home country, Myanmar. The government at the time allowed them to stay. But since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party or BJP came to power in 2014, there has been a growing clamor from Hindu groups who want to see Rohingya evicted. In response, earlier this year, the government announced plans to deport Rohingya. And now, Minister of State for Home Affairs, Kiran Rijiju, says the government is pushing ahead with the plan.
We have instructed all the state government to immediately constitute the task force in each district, identify the Rohingyas wherever they are, and start the process of deportation. So it's a legal process.
The government claims the Rohingya have links with terror groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and pose a serious threat to national security. But human rights groups reject this claim. Colin Gonzalez is director of the New Delhi-based Human Rights Law Network.
The UNHCR has interviewed all these refugees. The UNHCR has given all of them a refugee card. And the refugee card says this person, if he is sent back to his country, will suffer persecution and death. Then the UNHCR itself does a very thorough investigation into the background of a person. So they are thoroughly screened. They have certified all of them to be genuine refugees. They will not give a card to a person who is a terrorist.
The United Nations has severely criticized India for the decision to deport Rohingyas. India's National Human Rights Commission has also said that this is a human rights issue. The government's decision has sparked massive protests across India, and thousands have come out in support for Rohingya refugees, demanding the government reverse its deportation decision. 45-year-old Nisar Ahmed is one of the protesters.
We stand with Rohingya and inciting with them. Today we are upholding the age-old Indian tradition of being open to refugees and people facing persecution and oppression. The government cannot go against this tradition.
The fight for Rohingyas has now reached the Supreme Court, with the Rohingyas themselves and some civil society groups petitioning for a hold on the proposed deportation. Senior Supreme Court lawyer Prashant Bhushan is representing the Rohingya petitioners in the court.
We have pointed out that this would be in gross violation of all principles of international law. Various international conventions, which India is a signatory to, which have said that you cannot send back refugees in a situation where there would be a serious threat to their life and limb, and therefore they should be allowed to remain here.
India is home to more than 2 million refugees from several countries. Many of them have been here for decades. But in the Rohingyas case, Bhushan says the government is trying to give a communal color to a humanitarian crisis.
It is really unfortunate that the government is going back on its commitment to refugees, which it has reiterated several times in the past, merely because these Rohingyas are Muslims. I mean, this is clearly a case of religious discrimination.
Despite government's advice that the court should stay out of it, the Supreme Court has decided to hear the plea. The hearing will begin next month. The fate of Rohingya refugees in India now hinges on the court verdict. From New Delhi, this is Bismillah Gilani for Asia Calling.
Last month, former Thai Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra fled the country in secret. And last week, she was sentenced to 5 years in prison in absentia. The last 12 years in Thailand have been marred by political unrest, including two military coups. And at the centre of that political volatility is the Shinawatra family, whose influence has towered over Thailand for a decade. They're billionaires, but they're also known for their policies that support the rural poor. They're loved by some and hated by others. Three members of the family have been elected prime minister only to be toppled from office. Asia Calling correspondent Kanika Pech Kao asks if the family's influence will live on despite their absence from the country.
Mayuri has driven 5 hours to arrive at Bangkok's court at dawn. She holds a box of homemade fish curry and boasts that the so-called Madam Prime Minister loves her cooking. Ask her yourself, she dares me. Mayuri is referring to the former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra, who was ousted from office 3 years ago. Outside the court, we waited for Yingluck to arrive and hear the court decide her future. We wait and wait, but Yingluck never arrives. Later we find out she fled the country the night before the verdict. Shinawatra supporter Hansak Banjasi Pitak says she was forced to leave.
The jurisdiction system, the fake witnesses, the destruction of evidence, impartial information taken into account. If I had to be sentenced to jail under this circumstance, I would flee too.
Yingluck Shinawatra was facing charges of negligence of duty for the Bangkok rice subsidy scheme that was supposed to support Thai farmers, but that ended in failure. Found guilty, she was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. But Chinawat supporters like Hansak claim the charges are politically motivated, an attempt to wipe out the Chinawat family and their supporters.
Anyone, not just the Nawatra family members, but all those who are close to them. If anyone were suspected to be in Sinawatra's shadow, they would be gotten rid of.
Yingluck Shinawat is the second prime minister to flee the country in the last 10 years. The first was her brother, Thaksin Shinawat. Billionaire-turned-politician, Thaksin Shinawat brought his family to fame when he contested elections in 2001. He enjoyed enormous support, especially from the rural poor. His party, Pheutai, won elections in landslide, and Thaksin became the first elected prime minister to complete a full term in office. In 2006, Thaksin Shinawat was ousted in a military coup. He fled the country, but his popularity remained strong, and Thailand was plunged into a deep divide between those who supported Thaksin and those who wanted to see him gone. Both sides took to the streets. Violent confrontation dragged the country to the brink of civil war. Despite political unrest and Thaksin's absence, the Chinawat family thrived. Thaksin's brother-in-law and then his sister were elected prime minister, although they were both removed from office by court rulings. But even their rivals, like former Prime Minister Apisit Wechachiwa, agree that the family's influence lives on.
The influence that the family continues to wield in terms of politicians and also the mass support that it still has means that they will continue to be a force in Thai politics. We have to be realistic about that.
The military junta has been in power for 3 years now. Democratic elections are promised for next year, but no one is holding their breath. Civil rights and political freedoms have been eroded, and political opponents crushed. But prominent journalist Tepa Chai Yong says the situation is far from settled.
Just the fact that Yingluck has fled the country doesn't mean that it will spur an end to the support these people have for the family. Maybe on the contrary, the fact that Yingluck is seen as being forced to leave the country may play into the hands of the Chinawat family in the sense that it gives the impression that the family members, especially Khun Yingluck, are being wrongly persecuted.
Many still support the Chinawat family, but under the military junta, the road ahead will not be easy for them. Chinawat supporter Hansak tells me he wants to see a reconciliation between the military and Chinawat supporters. He says that unless these divisions are resolved in a fair process, they will continue to dominate Thai politics.
If we want real reconciliation and to move on, all facts should be considered, those of the victims and of the perpetrators. If you don't consider the truth from all sides, we will definitely stay stuck.
For Asia Calling, I'm Kanika Petkao. From Thailand.
You're listening to Asia Calling KBR. Back in the 15th century, Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, was a lively centre for the production and export of herbal medicines. Now, 6 centuries later, herbal treatments are still popular in Afghanistan. Asia Calling correspondent Gail Waziri visited a herbal medicine market in Kabul to find out more.
In Kabul's crowded old city, dozens of shops are lined with piles of colorful dried herbs setting out in the open. The fragrance wafts into the street. Hindu shopkeepers wear red, blue, and black turbans and have long, bushy beards they tell they have been making and selling herbal medicine here for generations. Dharmandar Singh is a Hindu sage, a wise mystic. People here call him Lala Dilsoz, which means kind big brother in Persian. He sees more than 30 patients a week, asking them detailed questions about their body before setting them on their way with herbal Christians. Singh is one of 100 Hindu sages in Kabul who specialize in herbal treatments.
This treatment is centuries old and it is relevant even now. Herbal medicines get positive result amongst 100% of the time with no side effects. That is why people still come to us and encourage their relatives to come too.
Herbal medicine is known as a Greek treatment in Afghanistan. That is because it was brought to Afghanistan from Greece. It's widely believed that these herbal remedies came with the invasion of Alexander the Great of Macedonia in 330 before Christian. Now most herbal medicine practitioners are Hindus whose ancestors arrived in Afghanistan from India around 300 years ago. In one of the shops here, Safiullah Alakoze is making herbal tonics.
As you see now, I am making medicine for sexual virility. It's made from 5 different herbs.
Plants like saffron, cumin, coriander, licorice root, olive, and garlic are separated out. Each herb is pummeled in a separate metal bottle. Then they are mixed in a special combinations, sometimes with a drop of water, oil or honey.
Most of these herbs are collected from provinces around Afghanistan by villagers who understand herbs. Then they bring it to us to sell. We know which herb works for which disease. Then I make medicine from it.
40-year-old Ismail Omar is buying a tonic for his rheumatism. He tells me the treatment is cheap and effective.
Once I had pain in my backbone. When I got herbal treatment, I got better. That's why I come here for my rheumatism treatment too. Our ancestors used this treatment before there was no modern medicine. I think it's the best method.
Those living in rural Afghanistan strongly rely on herbal treatments. It's cheaper and more readily available in areas that have few health clinics and poor transportation. But not everyone is convinced that is a good option. 24-year-old Hasib Mohammadi tells me he is experienced painful side effects after using herbal treatments. And medical expert Dr. Abdul Jabbar Mumenyar from Nangarhar University says that many sages are illiterate, relying on informal verbal wisdom passed down from one person to the next. He argues herbal treatment should be standardized for the safety of patients.
If you want to use herbal treatment, it needs to be standardized in coordination with the Ministry of Health and taught through university and books. Otherwise, herbal treatment could be harmful.
Farisha Kaling, I am Ghayur Waziri in Kabul, Afghanistan.
Have you ever watched a documentary and felt like you really got to know the characters and then wondered what happened to them after, if the documentary had an impact on their lives or not? Well, a Jakarta-based initiative is setting out to make sure that documentaries don't just leave you with a nice or troubled feeling. Good Pitch wants to convert those feelings into social change. I caught up with the team behind Filipino documentary Audio Perpetua to find out more.
People call me back home as Carol Katakutan. Katakutan in Filipino means frightened or scared.
Is there any truth in that name?
I always say that you better be scared of me because, you know, I'm quite a tough person.
Dressed in a pastel purple cardigan and with a warm smile overtaking her face, when I met her in Jakarta recently, Carol didn't seem very scary. But I did get the feeling that if she put her mind to something, she'd be formidable. Carol's at the centre of a documentary, currently in production, about people with vision impairments in the Philippines. She also tells me that she has a one-of-a-kind claim. She's the only blind person in the Philippines who has ever written scripts for television.
It's a very visual medium, right? So it's like a blind telling a story to someone with sight. And I already wrote 3 television scripts and 2 romance novels, which were published. But when I got involved in our organization, you know, it's a calling, it's a mission. So I gave up on all of that.
These days, Carol dedicates her time to Atrieve, a Manila-based organization that trains people with vision impairments to use computers and technology. Their aim is to equip visually impaired people with the skills that will get them professional work and give them the means to live independently.
When we started training blind people on computers, you know, a lot of opportunities were opened which were not there before. Like, you cannot imagine blind people as programmers. Now we have junior programmers. We have software developers. These are all our graduates. We have call center agents. We have transcriptionists. We have virtual assistants. So these opportunities wouldn't have been available to them without the technology that they learned from Atrieve.
The Philippines is one of the world's call center capitals, with 1.2 million people working in the industry. That means there's plenty of jobs in service and tech. But having the skills to get a job is just the first hurdle to overcome. Companies are often reluctant to employ people with vision impairments. And even when they do, they're not always treated equally.
Some people are not that patient with visually impaired people. They feel that some are very patronizing of them, and they don't want to feel like that. I mean, you don't have to patronize me. I can do my job, basically. So there's those difficulties.
That's Ivy Baldoza. She's currently making the documentary film called Audio Perpetua, which follows the trainees at Atrieve. The film's producer, Melanie Atuna, explained.
Actually, it's always a question that is asked to us. Why will we hire people with disabilities when we can hire people that are very able, right? And so this documentary is important because we wanted to show and create this kind of awareness that you can hire people with disabilities.
After 3 years of filming and production, the documentary is now in its final stages. But Melanie says she won't be content just to release the film and hope for the best. So Ivy and Melanie have partnered with Jakarta-based initiative Good Pitch, a not-for-profit initiative that facilitates funding and links to help incite change through film.
And we want to provide sensitivity workshops for the sighted people so that they know how to deal with people who are visually impaired. We wanted to educate employers on how to hire visually impaired people and how to deal with them when they're in a professional environment. We want to create awareness, so screenings, more screenings in schools. We are looking for tech and gadget support.
And Melanie says they're making sure the film won't be off limits to those who feature in it.
Apart from making the documentary, we are doing an audio description of the film to make this an extraordinary experience for them. Audio description meaning we will have a voice talent describe with feelings all the scenes happening, and then you cut it in the sound bites from the subjects. And so even without seeing it, it's going to be an experience for them.
As for Carol, she says it's an honor to be in the film. Even if being shadowed by a film crew on and off for 2 years was a little strange at times. It might have got in the way of her movement, but it certainly didn't get in the way of her formidable style.
We always tell them that, oh, you tell you, you better get out of the way of the blind, otherwise we might run over your cameras. So we just be careful, you know.
For Asia Calling, I'm Nicole Kirby in Jakarta. That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling for more updates. You can now also podcast the show. Go to the iTunes Store or your podcasting app and search for Asia Calling to subscribe for free to the weekly episodes. I'm Nicole Kirby, back next week with more stories from Asia.